Before walking me through all the details of the massive jobs plan President Biden laid out last week, I asked Slate's Jordan Weissman to do something a little different. I asked him to take me 2 decades in the future and tell me what the world around us could look like, assuming Biden's entire list of goodies made it through Congress.
In 20 years. Okay, let's close our eyes and imagine. In 20 years from now, you are in your electric vehicle, which you don't have to worry about charging because there will be chargers all over the country. There will be, you know, nobody at any gas station or rest stop, you'll be able to charge your car. And you are riding to work on a highway that is actually fixed. You don't have to worry about traffic congestion so much because our highways have been fixed up and modernized and bridges have been repaired. So you don't have orange cones everywhere holding up the morning commute. You no longer have to worry about whether or not your kids are getting poisoned by your tap water because we've taken out and replaced all the lead pipes, which is good.
Okay, this vision is making me realize what a hellscape we currently live in.
Right?
Some people have called Biden's American Jobs Plan an infrastructure bill, and it does fund roads and bridges, the electrical grid and water pipes. But in a few weeks, the second half of this plan is going to be released, the American Families Plan. And together, the ideas inside these plans aim to redefine what infrastructure is. They're looking to bolster human infrastructure along with everything else. There's something else I noticed about Biden's bills here. They use the word America a lot. You've got the American Jobs Plan. In a few weeks, we're going to have the American Families Plan. It's a whole lot of America. Is that intentional?
Yeah, I assume so. I mean, like, why not just put America on everything? Yeah, it's patriotic. It's a new nationalism. Part of the theory of Bidenomics is that we can have a rich country where things are less crappy. That's sort of rather than a rich country where a lot of stuff is crappy.
You use this term Bidenomics. Do you feel like over the last few months, you're getting a better idea of what Bidenomics is?
Yeah, I think we're starting to. And I think in a lot of ways, it is an inversion of Reaganomics. It's he's sort of flipping the script on what was the prevailing economic ideology for 30, almost 40 years.
Today on the show, you've read about the president's new infrastructure plan. We'll talk about the way this plan embraces a new kind of American populism, one that could appeal to Democrats and Republicans. I'm Mary Harris. You're listening to What Next? Stick around.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Let's do some basics. Because
sure.
We're talking about two bills here, the American Jobs Plan and the American Families Plan. When Joe Biden announced the American Jobs Plan, he said, I'm going to be back in a couple of weeks to talk about this other plan, and really, really basically laid out that these are paired together. He sees them as bound together. But we know a lot more about the Jobs Plan. So let's go over it a little bit. It's an infrastructure bill that's very expansive about what infrastructure is, right?
So the media has started calling this an infrastructure bill, and that's because that's the way it was discussed around Washington. But I actually don't think that's the most appropriate way to think about it. In a lot of ways, it's more of an economic modernization bill, right? It's a lot more expansive than just roads and bridges and, you know, car charging ports. It really has four key pillars. And if you count the way it's financed, the tax side, maybe it has a fifth key pillar. We can talk about those. One of those is just straight up infrastructure. You know, like we think about it, roads, bridges, you know, there's a part of the bill that says we're going to fix the 10 most economically important bridges in the country.
$621 billion for roads and bridges.
Yeah, well, it's not $620 billion on just 10 bridges, thankfully. We're also fixing 10,000 smaller bridges, but also fixing up highways, basic stuff like that, as well as, you know, improving, you know, retrofitting schools and, you know, taking out lead pipes, things along those lines. Another pillar of it is decarbonization, right? It's sort of the climate bill is being wrapped into this. It's everything from, like you said, electric vehicles to this clean electricity standard that they're somehow going to put in there. It's a little bit unclear, but the idea is that we're going to require more of our electricity come from carbon-free and environmentally friendly sources. There's, you know, energy R&D. There's all sorts of good. There are all sorts of goodies in there that have the climate folks extremely excited right now.
And all of this sounds like traditional infrastructure, maybe a little bit focused on climate change, but pretty like meat and potatoes infrastructure spending. But then it kind of goes in a different direction.
Right. I mean, when you're rebuilding the electric grid, that is infrastructure, right? It's absolutely essential to you know, decarbonizing our power sources, but it's also just meat and potatoes making work for construction workers, and it's productive work. But then there is this other aspect of the bill. There's you know, there's a big chunk of it's devoted to R&D spending and trying to kind of cultivate
research and development.
Research and development, cultivating the industries of the future. There's you know, there's this idea where we're going to create this sort of new technology directorate under the National Science Foundation and channel more money into advanced manufacturing. We're going to try and create a domestic battery industry, which has been kind of the great white whale for American policy makers who are interested in industrial policy for a while now. And
batteries, so we don't rely on fossil fuels as much.
Well, also so we don't have to rely on batteries that are built abroad in China, for instance. The idea is that, you know, it's not just decarbonizing or building the industries of tomorrow, but that we're building the industries of tomorrow and bringing them here to the U.S. There is an amount of economic nationalism here. Instead of using tariffs, though, like Donald Trump did, the idea is that you're going to, you're going to provide, you know, government incentives and funding and resources in order to build these industries up domestically.
But one of the bigger line items is long-term care for the elderly and disabled. And you read that and you think, infrastructure? Is that infrastructure? Yeah. Do I need to rethink what infrastructure is?
Yeah, I mean, it's led to a lot of joking about how if you want to get a policy passed in Washington now, you just have to call it, you know, you have to call it infrastructure. You know, I mean, it's a stretch to call that infrastructure. They call it care infrastructure, right? But or human infrastructure. But I think there are a few ways to think about that part of the bill. Part of it is that the reality is that the United States is just getting older. There are going to be a lot of elderly people in the future, and they're going to need, you know, someone to take care of them. And we could just put them all in nursing homes, but that's not really ideal. And allowing people to stay at home is in their own homes is in a lot of ways more humane. It might actually be more affordable. I think it's something people would prefer. And so this is kind of forward looking in that respect, saying, okay, well, this is going to be a big part of the workforce, and we should make sure that, you know, people A, can afford home care, and B, that the people who are doing the care, the caretakers, are paid appropriately.
This plan's got a $2 trillion price tag. It would largely be paid for by tax hikes. Biden's plan is to roll back some of the corporate tax breaks offered under the Trump administration.
There are some more subtle and interesting things going on underneath the hood that I think might freak out some conservatives and sort of the Chamber of Commerce, which is already pushing back. There are ways we treat international income under this tax plan are a very big deal. Gabe Zuckman, the Berkeley economist who's known for his work on tax havens and inequality, is very excited about these changes. He's always been an advocate for a kind of global minimum corporate tax. And it actually seems like some of the changes in this bill are meant to advance that agenda. And actually, Janet Yellen, the Treasury Secretary, has been kind of beginning to lobby her global her global peers, her global counterparts on this idea of maybe trying to impose some sort of global minimum corporate tax rate.
We're working with G20 nations to agree to a global minimum corporate tax rate that can stop the race to the bottom.
Does this keep folks from hiding money, essentially?
Not so much hiding money, but it's meant to, prevent, regular tax competitions between countries and also, deal with tax havens.
Folks are already looking down the line and saying, okay, if this plan made it through Congress, how would it do it? And it sounds like if this moves through, the likelihood is that this would need to be a party line vote again. Folks are already talking about the Senate using reconciliation again, which they just did for the stimulus, which is a budget procedure that technically most people believe can only be done one time a year, but Democrats are lobbying that they can do it three times a year. I'm wondering what you make of all this.
Yeah, it's going to be a beast. Passing this thing is not going to be easy, but either politically or procedurally, right? Because anytime, spending money is a little bit hard. Spending money and raising taxes is very hard. And doing it with a complicated procedural tool that limits what you can and can't pass makes it even more difficult. Reconciliation is, I've written so many words about it on Slate.com, and I can write more words. I'm kind of glad Chuck Schumer is trying to press to see if he can pass multiple reconciliation bills in a year. I actually mentioned that offhandedly as an idea in a piece a while back because it was sort of floating around Congress that this was possible. And so it looks like, Senate Majority Leader Chuck has embraced it, which is cool.
And are we going to be talking about these ideas for a while? Like, is it going to take months to sort out? I mean, we just saw the stimulus pass really quickly. And so I feel like it kind of sets a bar of expectation where you're thinking, oh, things are passing quickly. But are we about to slow down here?
I think we're going to slow down a bit. Yeah. I mean, they're already talking about taking at least 3 months for this bill to pass. I would expect more, especially if they end up combining the infrastructure bill and this, families plan bill that they're talking about. If they end up just making it one monster piece of legislation, that could take a while. It's like if you put the entire New Deal into one piece of legislation, that's going to take a bit of time to sort out. So I think we are going to have a moment or two to kind of dwell on the aspects of this plan and what Congress comes up with and think it through, more so than we did with the coronavirus bill.
After the break, what is this infrastructure plan? Tell us about Bidenomics. This episode is brought to you by Discover. When it comes to your finances, Discover wants you to know they are the credit card that is always there for you. With 24/7 US-based live customer service, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We are talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
And we're back. So Mitch McConnell has come out against these plans broadly. But I have to say, looking at the pushback so far, this could be me not seeing things. But for some reason, it feels different to me than when, say, President Obama was pushing for the healthcare legislation that became Obamacare. You know, it was clear from the beginning of that fight it was going to be a slog, months long, negotiating. And for some reason, texturally, this moment feels different for me, even though we're talking about, again, trillions of dollars in spending. And I'm wondering if you can help me understand why.
I'm still trying to understand this, too. I think there are, you know, we can theorize together.
Jordan has a few theories about why the wind seems to be at the president's back right now, legislatively. There's the fact that Joe Biden isn't burdened by the scrutiny that came along with being the country's first black president. And then there's also timing. Unlike Barack Obama, who took office in the middle of an economic death spiral, Biden took control as the country was poised to recover from a collapse. But there's something else. The way Washington thinks about the economy, Jordan says, that seems to be changing. And that's true on both sides of the aisle.
The really simple way to put it is that it feels like most Americans, basically all Democrats, and a growing number of Republicans, though they aren't the majority within Congress by any means, feel like we've probably milked all we possibly can out of tax cuts and deregulation. It's just that's not the way forward for growth anymore. I'm kind of workshopping a piece about this, thinking about it. You know, Reaganism versus Bidenism. How is Bidenism a rejection of Reaganism? And I think it actually helps to start by thinking about what Reaganism was, right? Like, what was supply-side economics and what was it responding to? Close your eyes again. We've already imagined America 20 years from now. Like, close your eyes and...
Now we're going back in time.
Yeah, let's go back in time to, like, the 1970s. In the 1970s, it was this period of economic disappointment, of malaise, right? The big problem was we were dealing with a combination of high unemployment and inflation, known as stagflation. You had... You know, I think the causes of that are actually poorly understood to this day. But you had, you know, gas lines, you had the oil shocks caused by OPEC. It's actually largely forgotten that food prices were skyrocketing at the time. You know, just going to the grocery store, you were seeing, you know, your cost of your shopping cart going up constantly. It felt like America was just, the wheels were kind of coming off and no one fully got it. But there were a few ideas that became very popular. One was that if you pushed unemployment too low, right, if you just poured money into the economy, that would become inflationary, right? And that wasn't going to work anymore. You couldn't use the hand of government
because prices would go up.
You were in an era where the idea was that you were trying to control inflation, right? You were trying to grow the economy while controlling inflation, and so the notion was that government spending wasn't going to fix things. It was the problem that you couldn't just pour more money into the economy and hope that you were going to write things, that was going to set us in the right direction. Instead, what you needed to do was, you know, encourage more business investment. You needed to encourage more people to enter the workforce so that you could grow the economy without putting more pressure on, you know, without creating wage price spirals. That's just not the issue anymore. Instead, we're in this period where, if anything, there's a global savings glut. There's too much savings. There's too much, no matter how you look at it, there's just too much capital floating around. Interest rates are incredibly low. That is actually perhaps one of the single biggest problems now, is that interest rates have been just stubbornly low for decades.
So we've been fighting the last war.
Right. That was a very different war. And so now the problem isn't how do you get more capital into the economy? How do you get more investment? And how do you help rich people save so they'll invest? It's, oh, rich people are saving too much and they're not investing.
How do we get them to spend?
That's sort of the issue we're dealing with now. How do you create more spending, and how do you create more demand? Bidenism kind of responds to that. It's like, well, okay, the government is going to spend and create demand, and the government is going to invest directly. We're just going to do the investment ourselves. And so it is very much a reversal. And like, you know, when it comes to the corporate tax side of the plan, right? You know, I think it's economically significant that this plan is funded by taxing capital. It's funded by taxing corporations. The idea here is, yeah, we don't need to create more private savings. We don't need to increase the return to investors at this point.
We need to claw those savings into the government and invest them in everyday people.
We need to invest them in infrastructure and R&D. And, you know, you do need the hand of government now. And, you know, it's been, again, it's, you know, inflation was the worry then. And it's not the worry at this point. We're in such a different economic world that just Reaganism isn't responding to any of the issues that we have today. And Democrats have, you know, thoroughly understood that at this point, I think. And even Republicans, it's beginning to dawn on them.
We've talked a couple times about how this plan is pretty far from being a bill or a law. And you got into a bit of a debate with our colleague Henry Grabar about whether a version of this will even pass. And it was interesting to me because Henry was pretty pessimistic. He was like, no, I don't think this isn't gonna make it through. And you weren't. It made me wonder why you were so optimistic.
I have no good reason for being optimistic other than just the kind of vibe right now. Right? Like,
you know the vibes.
No, it is, but we were talking about it. Like, there is, you know, to go back to Reagan a bit, there's a little bit of a mourning in America feeling at the moment, right? That there's a light at the end of the tunnel with the pandemic, and we're not dealing with a lunatic in the White House anymore, and people seem to want to take advantage of the historical moment and seize the opportunity. And I feel like there's forward momentum, and you could get a little bit of a legislative flywheel going. You know, to use a terrible Silicon Valley term, but that progress is going to, you know, that progress will beget progress. It's sheer, dumb, naive optimism on my part that something like this might actually pass.
Jordan Weissman, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me on.
Jordan Weissman is Slate's senior business and economics correspondent. And that's the show. What Next is produced by Carmel Delshad, Mary Wilson, Daniel Hewitt, Elena Schwartz, and Davis Land. Alicia Montgomery and Allison Benedict edit us and make sure we do our year-end reviews. And I'm Mary Harris. My Twitter is where you can see one of two cakes I made for Easter. Go check it out. It's at Mary's Desk. And thanks for listening. I'll talk to you tomorrow.